Whose idea was this anyway? I ask. Sam snorts. Yours. Well, I have some stupid ideas sometimes.
True, but we have to get your chest somehow.
There's so much in there that I don't even know how to use yet. But maybe they do, I say. Then something catches my eye. Look at the ground in front of the entrance, I say, pointing to a smattering of dark objects by the cave's entrance.
At the rocks?
Those aren't rocks. Those are dead animals, I say. Sam shakes his head.
Great, he says.
I shouldn't be surprised, since Six told us about it. But the sight of them fills me with even more dread, which I didn't think possible. My mind races. All right, I say, sitting up. There's no time like the present. I kiss the top of Bernie Kosar's head, then run my hand down the length of his back, hoping this won't be the last time I ever see him. He tells me not to go, and I communicate back that I have to. No other choice. You're the best, BK. I love you, buddy. Then I stand. I take the bottom of my shirt in my right hand so I can remove the Zatharis from the bag without touching it. Sam messes with the buttons on his digital watch, putting it in stopwatch mode. We won't be able to read its face once we're invisible, but when the hour is up, the watch will beep, though I imagine by then we'll have figured it out. Ready? I ask. Together we take our first step, then a second, and then we're hiking down the trail that may very well lead to our imminent doom. I turn around only once, when I've nearly reached the cave, and see Bernie Kosar staring at us. Chapter 29. We get as close to the cave as we can without being seen, and we duck behind a tree. I place the Zatharis stone on the sticky side of a section of duct tape. Sam watches, with his fingers pinched around his stopwatch. Ready? I ask. He nods. I press the Zatharis and the tape to the very bottom of my sternum. I vanish instantly, and Sam hits the watch's button, eliciting a soft digital beep. I snatch Sam's hand, and together we lurch around the tree and speed to the cave. It's all about the task at hand now, and with that in mind, I'm no longer as nervous. The cave is covered with a large camouflage tarp. We navigate through the graveyard of dead animals, being careful not to step on any, which is hard to do without the luxury of seeing your feet. There are no Moogs outside, and I hurry forward and flick the tarp aside, a little too forcefully. Sam and I stumble in, and four guards jump up from their seats and raise cylindrical cannons like the one that was held to my forehead that night in Florida. We stand as still as statues for a brief moment, and then quietly sneak past, hoping they'll attribute the tarp's sudden disturbance to the outside wind. There's a cool breeze coming from a ventilation system, and the air is oddly fresh, which I hadn't expected considering it's laced with poisonous gas. The gray walls are polished smooth like flint. Electrical conduit connects dim lights evenly spaced 20 feet apart. We pass several more scouts and slither by undetected. The anxiety of the ticking clock racks us both with stress. We jog. We sprint. We tiptoe. We walk. And when the tunnel narrows and declines steadily, we sidestep down it. The cool air grows hot and stifling, and a crimson glow at the end of the tunnel comes into view. We shuffle towards it until finally reaching the cave's beating heart. The cavernous hall is far larger than I'd imagined based on Six's description. A long, continuous ledge runs along the circular walls and spirals all the way from top to bottom, giving the overall appearance of a beehive. And the place is every bit as busy as one, too. There are literally hundreds of Moogs in sight, crossing the precarious stone-arched bridges, entering and exiting tunnels. The deep floor and the vast ceiling are separated by a half mile, and Sam and I are situated very close to the middle. Two massive pillars sprout up from the floor and reach all the way to the ceiling, keeping the whole thing from caving in. The number of passageways around us is endless.
"My God," Sam whispers in awe,
taking it all in.
"It'd take months to explore this entire thing."
My eyes are drawn to the lake of glowing green liquid down below. Even from so far away, the heat off it makes it hard to breathe. But despite the near roasting temperatures, 20 to 30 Moogs work around it, retrieving carts full of the bubbling stuff and quickly taking it away. Past the green lake, my eyes focus on something else.
"I think we can pretty much guess what we'll find down that tunnel with the giant bars," I whisper.
It's three times the height and width of the passageway that carried us here, and a checkered pattern of heavy iron bars covers it,
keeping caged whatever beasts are inside.
We can hear them howl from below, deep and almost sorrowful. One thing is immediately clear. Their numbers are far from few.
"It'll literally take months," Sam says again in a disbelieving whisper. "Well, we have less than an hour," I whisper back. "So we better hurry. I think we can put a big X through all those dark, narrow tunnels that look obstructed."
"I agree. We should start with the one directly across from us," I say,
looking at what appears to be the central room's main artery. Wider and better lit than the others, the one with the greatest number of Moogs coming and going. The bridge over to it is just a long arch of solid rock that, at most, is 2 feet wide.
"Think you can make it across that archway?"
"We're about to find out," Sam replies.
"Lead or follow?" I ask.
"Let me lead."
Sam takes his first few steps uncertainly. Since we have to keep our hands locked, for the first 40 feet or so, we shuffle along sideways. It takes forever. And if we're to get to the other side and back again, there's no way we can do it at this pace.
"Just don't look down," I say to Sam.
"Don't be cliché," he responds, squaring his body.
We move ahead slowly, and I wish I could see my feet for just this obstacle. I'm so focused on not falling that I don't feel Sam stop ahead of me, which causes me to stumble into him, nearly knocking us both off the bridge.
"What are you doing?"
I ask, my heart thudding in my chest. I look up and see why he stopped. Racing towards us is a Mogadorian soldier. He comes charging across in a jog, and he's already so close there's hardly time to react.
"There's nowhere to go," Sam says.
The soldier continues forward, cradling a wrapped bundle in his arms, and when he's close enough, I feel Sam crouch. A second later, the Moog's feet are swept out from under him, completely catching the soldier off guard. He falls over the side of the bridge and catches himself with one hand as the bundle he was carrying drops away. The Moog cries out in pain as my invisible foot crushes his fingers, and he lets go and drops through the air, splattering far below with a sickly thud. Sam races us forward before any further calamities arise. Every single Moog in the area has stopped in mid-stride, staring at one another with confused expressions. I wonder if they believe what just happened was an accident, or if they're now on alert. Sam squeezes my hand in relief when we've made it across, and he lurches ahead, having gained a world of confidence from killing the soldier. The next corridor is wide and busy, and it doesn't take long for Sam and me to realize we're heading in the wrong direction. The rooms we pass are exclusively private, and the entire wing seems to be where the Moogs live. Caves with beds, a large open cafeteria with hundreds of tables, a shooting range. We rush down a nearby corridor, but the result is the same. And then we try a third. We follow the winding tunnel deeper into the mountain. Several tributaries lead away from the main drag, and Sam and I randomly turn down them based on nothing more than gut feeling. Aside from the main hall we entered, the rest of the mountain is nothing more than an interconnected network of damp stone corridors, off of which various rooms house research centers with examination tables, computers, and shiny, sharp instruments. We pass several scientific laboratories that we both wish we had the time to investigate further as we rush by. We've probably run a mile, maybe two, and with each new corridor that turns up nothing, stress floods my veins.
We can't have more than 15 minutes left, John.
I'm aware of that, I whisper, desperate and irritated and quickly losing hope. When we take the next turn and rush up a steady incline, we pass the thing I'd feared most, a room full of prison cells. Sam stops in mid-stride and keeps a firm grip on my hand, causing me to stop as well. 20 to 30 Mogadorians guard more than 40 cells, all lined up in a row, with heavy steel doors. In front of each door, there's a bubbling blue force field pulsing with electricity.
Look at all those cells, Sam says.
I know he's thinking of his dad.
Wait a second,
I say. The solution flashing into my head from out of nowhere, it's so obvious.
What?
Sam asks.
I know where the chest is,
I say.
Seriously? So stupid of me,
I whisper.
Sam, if you could pick just one place in this entire hellhole where you'd absolutely refuse to go, where would that place be? In the pit with the howling beasts,
he answers without a second's hesitation.
Exactly,
I say.
Come on, let's go.
I lead him back up the corridor that'll empty out at the cave center. But before we've left the cells behind, a door clangs open, and Sam jerks his hand to stop me.
Look, he says.
The nearest cell door stands wide open. Two guards enter. They speak angrily for 10 seconds in their native tongue, and when they exit, they're clutching the arms of a pale, emaciated man in his late 20s. He's weak to the point of having trouble walking, and Sam's grip tightens as the guards shove him forward. One of them unlocks a second door, and all three disappear through it.
Who do you think they have locked up in there?
He asks as I pull him forward.
We gotta go, Sam, I say. We don't have the time. They're torturing humans, John,
he says when we finally reach the central hive.
Human beings.
I know, I say, scanning the mammoth room for the quickest route down. There are Moogs everywhere, but I've become so used to passing by them that they no longer bother me. And besides, something tells me I'm about to find far scarier things than scouts and soldiers.
People with families who probably have no idea where they've disappeared to,
Sam whispers.
I know, I say. Come on, we'll talk about it when we're out of here. Maybe Six will have some sort of plan.
We sprint around the spiral ledge and start down a tall ladder, but find it's nearly impossible to do so while holding the person's hand above you. I look down. There's still a far way to go.
We have to jump,
I say to Sam.
Otherwise it'll take 10 minutes to get all the way down there. Jump,
he asks incredulously.
It'll kill us.
Don't worry, I assure him. I'll catch you.
How the hell are you going to catch me if I'm holding your hand the whole time?
But there isn't time to argue or debate. I take a deep breath and leap from the ledge 100 feet above the cave's bottom. Sam howls, but the continuous clatter of manufacturing drowns out the noise. My feet hit the unyielding stone, and the force knocks me backwards, but I keep a firm grip on Sam, who lands on top of me.
Never again are we doing that, he says, standing.
The ground floor is so hot it's nearly impossible to breathe. But we sprint around the green lake towards the massive gate, keeping the beasts locked away. When we reach it, a cool wind gusts through the bars, and I realize that the regular blasts of fresh air prevent any of the gas from entering this tunnel.
John, I really don't think there's any time left, Sam pleads.
I know, I say, letting a group of 10 or so Moogs exit ahead of us. We enter a dark tunnel. The walls look mucus-covered, and barred chambers line each side of the shaft. Down the middle of the ceiling, 10 huge industrial fans blow, all pointed towards the entry we just came through, keeping the air cool and moist. Some of the locked chambers are small, though others are large, and bursting out of them, all are feral and ferocious sounds. In the cage on our left are 20 to 30 crawls jumping over one another while letting loose shrill yips. Imprisoned on our right is a pack of demonic-looking dogs the size of wolves, with yellow eyes and no hair. Beside them stands a creature that looks like a troll, complete with a wart-covered nose. In a larger cell, across the way, is a massive pikin, not unlike the one who busted through the prison wall that morning, paces back and forth, sniffing the air.
We might as well not even bother with these smaller rooms, I say. If my chest is here, it'll be in the biggest room at the end of this tunnel. I don't even want to take a guess at what kind of beast needs a door that large to fit through. We're down to seconds, John.
We better hurry then, I say, pulling Sam forward while quickly taking in the different horrors corralled here. Gargoyle-like winged creatures, monsters with 6 arms and red skin, several more pikins standing 20 feet tall, a wide reptilian mutant with trident-shaped horns, a monster with skin so transparent that its internal organs are on display.
Whoa,
I say, stopping in a group of rounded tanks and vessels, most of which are silver, though 2 are copper-colored and lined with heat gauges. Some kind of boiler room, I guess.
So that's what's keeping this place going, Sam says. This has to be it, I reply.
The tallest silo goes to the ceiling, and every tank is connected with heavy pipes, spouts, and aluminum ducts. Beside the silo, a control panel is affixed to the wall with a heap of electrical wires pouring out.
Come on, Sam says, impatiently jerking my hand.
Together, we run the rest of the way to the tunnel's end. There's a massive door, 40 to 50 feet tall and wide, made entirely of steel. To its right is a small wooden door. It's unlocked, and instantly I see why.
Holy God, Sam whispers, taking in the beast's enormity.
I'm momentarily stunned myself, and all I can do is stare at it. A hulking mass slumped in the room's far corner. Its eyes are closed, and it breathes rhythmically. The beast must be 50 feet tall when standing. And, from what I can tell, its dark body is shaped like a man's, but with much longer arms.
I want nothing to do with this place, Sam says.
You sure? I ask, nudging him so his gaze leaves the monster.
Look.
There, in the center of the room, at eye level atop a thick stone pedestal, is my chest. And right beside it, sits a second one, almost identical in appearance. Both of them, there for the taking. Except for the iron bars around them, which are housed beneath a humming and crackling electrical force field surrounded by a moat of the steaming green liquid. And the slumbering giant.
That's not Six's chest, I say,
What are you talking about? Who else's would it be?
Sam asks, confused.
They found us, Sam.
In Florida, they found us by opening Six's chest.
Right, I know.
But look at the padlock on it. Why would they put the lock back on a chest that they probably had a hell of a time getting into in the first place? I think that one's never been opened.
Maybe you're right.
It could be any of ours, I whisper, shaking my head while staring up at them both. Number fives, or nines, or anyone's who isn't dead yet.
So they stole the chest and didn't kill the guard?
Like they did with me. Or maybe the Moogs caught one of them and they're being held here like Six was, I say.
Sam doesn't get a chance to answer. Because just then, the alarm on his wristwatch begins to beep. 3 seconds later, it's followed by the whine of 100 sirens echoing off the walls of the cave.
Aw, hell,
I say, turning my head. I can see you, Sam. He nods, a panicked look on his face. He lets go of my hand.
I could see you, too.
When I look over Sam's shoulder, the beast's eyes have come open, blank and white, narrowing in our direction.
Chapter 30. The gunfire makes my ears ring long after it's stopped. Smoke rises from the end of the barrel, but Creighton wastes no time and drops the gun's clip and snaps another in place. Heaping mounds of ash have given the air a thick haze. We stand waiting. Ella and I behind Creighton. He keeps the gun raised, his finger hovering on the trigger. A Mogadorian climbs into the entryway with a cannon of his own. But Creighton fires first, cutting him in half and hurling him backwards. The Mogadorian explodes before he hits the wall. A second jumps into view, wielding the same flashing weapon that tore my shoulder downstairs, but Creighton disposes of it before any light comes forth.
Well, they know where we are now. Come on!
He yells, rushing forward and down the stairs before I can offer to float us out the window. Ella and I follow, still holding hands. Creighton stops after the second curve of the stairwell, pressing his fingers to his eyes.
There's too much ash in my eyes. I can't see anything, he says. Marina, take the lead. If there's anything up ahead, yell and get the hell out of the way.
I keep the chest tucked beneath my left arm, and Ella stays in the middle, holding my hand and Creighton's. I lead them down and out the broken oak door, just as the tower above us explodes. I scream, ducking down and pulling Ella with me. Creighton instinctively begins firing. The gun unloads a rapid stream of ammunition, 8 to 10 bullets per second, and I can see an entire group of Mogadorians drop. Creighton stops firing.
Marina,
he asks, nodding his head forward without seeing me. I turn and study the hallway, thick with ash.
I think it's clear, I say,
and the second the words leave my mouth, a Mogadorian leaps out of an open doorway and fires, sending a flashing white meteor raging towards us, too bright to look at. We drop just in time, and the white death misses us by a hair. Creighton quickly lifts the gun and returns a barrage of bullets, killing the Mogadorian instantly. I lead us forward. I have no idea how many of them Creighton just killed, but the ash stands thick on the floor, covering our feet and ankles. We pause at the top of the steps. Light from the windows comes through the fading ash, and Creighton has cleared his eyes. He takes the lead position, clutching the gun tightly to his chest, while staying hidden behind the corner. Once we turn, all that separates us from the door leading outside are these steps. A short hallway, the back of the nave, and the main vestibule. Creighton takes a deep breath nods his head, and then turns, dropping the barrel of the gun, ready to fire. But there's nothing to fire at.
Come on!
He grunts. We follow him, and he escorts us across the nave's rear, which is black with fire damage. For a brief moment, I glimpse Adelina's body, looking small from as far away as we are. My heart aches seeing her. Be brave, Marina, her words echo. An explosion erupts against the outside wall on our right side. The stones blow inward, and I instinctively lift my hand and prevent any of them from hitting Ella and me. But Creighton gets hit, hard, and he smashes against the wall to our left, landing with a grunt. The gun rattles away from him, and a Mogadorian enters the cathedral through the newly created hole. He's holding a cannon, and in one fluid motion, I heave the Mogadorian backwards with my mind, bring Creighton's gun into my hand, and pull the trigger. The gun's kick is a lot harder than I expected, and I almost drop it, but I recover quickly and keep firing until the Mogadorian is reduced to ash. Here, I say, pushing the gun into Ella's hands, and in the comfortable way she takes it, I can tell she's no stranger to firearms. I rush to Creighton. His arm is broken, and blood seeps from gashes on his head and face. But his eyes are open, and he seems alert. I slap my hands on his wrist and close my eyes, the iciness crawling over my body and extending to Creighton. I watch the bones in his arm move under the skin, and the gashes on his face seal and disappear. His chest expands and contracts so fast, I think his lungs are going to explode. But then he's calm again. He sits up and moves his arm fluidly.
"Nice job," he says.
He takes the gun from Ella, and we climb through the hole in the wall and out into Santa Teresa's front grounds. I don't see a single person as Ella and I run ahead and pass through the iron gates, while Creighton sweeps his gun back and forth, looking for any reason to fire it. My eyes are drawn over Creighton's left shoulder to a quick burst of red from the cathedral's roof. With a loud blast, the discharged rocket surges towards Creighton. I stare at the rocket's tip and raise my hands, concentrating harder than I ever have, and at the very last instant, I am able to slightly alter the rocket's path. It misses him and angles off towards a mountain, where it hits it with a plume of fire. Creighton rushes us through the gates with eyes alert and the gun aimed. He pulls up and spins around. He shakes his head, and from behind us, we hear the church doors thrust open.
"He isn't here,"
Creighton says. And just before he turns around to begin firing, the sound of squealing tires pierces the air. The plastic covering that had kept the truck concealed falls off, and its backside fishtails as Hector, wide-eyed behind the wheel, floors it. He comes racing our way and slams on the brakes when he reaches us. The truck screeches to a halt, and Hector reaches across the seat and throws open the passenger side door. I toss my chest beside Hector, and Ella and I jump in. Creighton stays out just long enough to empty his gun at the Mogadorians emerging from the church door. Several drop, but there are far too many to get them all. Creighton jumps in and slams the door, and the tires bite into the cobblestones in an attempt to find traction. There's the sound of another rocket nearing, but the tires catch, and we go racing down Calle Principal.
"I love you, Hector," I say. "I can't help it." The sight of him behind the wheel fills me with such warmth that it brims over the edge.
"I love you too, Marina. I always told you, stick with Hector Ricardo. He'll take care of you."
"I never doubted it once," I say,
which is a lie. I had doubted it this morning. We reach the bottom of the hill and fly past the signs announcing the town limits. I twist around to peer out the back window as Santa Teresa quickly fades behind us. I know it's the last time I'll ever see it, and though I've waited years to leave, it now holds the sacredness of being Adelina's last resting place. Soon the town is gone, left behind.
Thank you, Señorita Marina, Hector says.
For what?
I know it was you who cured my dear mother. She told me it was you, that you were her angel, and I'll never be able to repay you for it.
You already have, Hector. I was very happy to help. He shakes his head.
I haven't yet, but I'm sure going to try.
While Creighton refills both clips and takes inventory of his ammo, Hector navigates the windy and unpredictable road. We bounce and skid along the sharp turns and sudden hills. But despite the speed, it doesn't take long for a convoy of vehicles to be seen in the distance behind us.
Don't worry about them, Creighton says. Just get us to the lake.
Even though the truck is barreling down the road, the convoy closes the gap. After 10 minutes, a flash of light sails just over the truck and explodes into the countryside ahead of us. Hector instinctively jerks his head down.
My God! He says.
Creighton turns around and breaks the back window with the butt of his gun, then fires. The lead vehicle is upended, which makes us all cheer in celebration.
That should keep them far enough back, Creighton says,
quickly reloading the gun's clip. And it does for a few minutes, but as the road grows more precarious and twists down the mountain at sharp declines, the vehicles catch right back up to us. Hector mutters under his breath as he whips around each bend, the gas pedal buried, the truck's back tires swinging frighteningly over the edge of the towering cliff.
Careful, Hector, Creighton says. Don't kill us before we get there. At least give us a chance.
Hector is in control,
Hector replies, bringing no comfort whatsoever to Creighton, who keeps a white-knuckled grip on the headrest in front of him. The only refuge is the road's perpetual turns, which keep the Mogadorians from getting a straight shot, though they try anyway. As we race around a particularly sharp bend, Hector can't turn as quickly enough, and we go off the edge of the road. At a 75-degree angle, the truck races down the dense mountainside, smashing through saplings, bouncing off boulders, barely avoiding thick trees. Ella and I scream. Creighton yells as he flies forward and slams into the windshield. Hector doesn't say a word. He clenches his teeth and maneuvers us around and over obstacles until we miraculously land on another road. The truck's hood is severely dented and smoking, but the engine is still running.
This is a shortcut, Hector says.
He tries the gas pedal, and we quickly rumble down the new road.
I think we lost them, says Creighton, looking up the cliff.
I pat Hector's shoulder and laugh. Creighton sticks the barrel of his gun out the back window and waits. Eventually, the lake comes into view. I wonder why Creighton believes the lake will save us.
What's the big deal about the lake? I ask.
You didn't think I'd come to find you with just Ella, did you?
For a moment, I think to tell him that up until a few hours ago, I thought he had come to kill me. But soon, the Mogadorians appear behind us again, and Creighton turns around while Hector's eyes dart up to the rearview mirror.
This is going to be close, Creighton says.
We'll get out of it, Papa, Ella says,
looking at Creighton, and hearing her call him that fills my heart with affection. He smiles warmly at her, then nods. Ella squeezes my hand.
You'll love Olivia, she says to me.
Who's Olivia? I ask, but she doesn't get a chance to answer before the road turns at a 90-degree angle and declines sharply towards the lake ahead. Ella tenses in my arms as the road ends, and Hector barely lets up on the gas as the truck rams straight through a chain-link gate that surrounds the lake. We hit a slight bump, and the truck's tires leave the ground entirely before landing with a thud and bouncing on the shore. Hector speeds straight for the water, and just before we reach it, he slams on the brakes and brings us skidding to a stop. Creighton shoulders open the passenger side door and dashes towards the lake, rushing straight into the water until it reaches his knees. With the gun still in his left hand, he hurls an object as far as he can with his right and begins muttering something in a language I don't understand.
"Come on!"
he screams, thrusting his hands up in the air as though offering encouragement.
"Come on, Olivia!"
Hector, Ella, and I rush out and run up near him. I have the chest under my arm, and in an instant, I see that the water has begun to crest and bubble in the lake's middle.
"Marina, do you know what a chimera is?"
But I don't get to answer, because just then, a lone Mogadorian vehicle, a tank-like Humvee with a gun mounted on top, erupts onto the scene and speeds down the hill. As it comes right at us in the water, Creighton unloads a barrage of bullets into the windshield. The vehicle instantly goes out of control, crashing straight into the back of Hector's truck. It creates a deafening bang, followed by the crush of grinding metal and breaking glass. As the dozens of other vehicles in the convoy rumble down the last hill and begin firing, the world erupts in fire and smoke as explosions rock the beach, causing all four of us to hit the ground. Sand and water rain down, and we scramble back to our feet. Creighton snags me by the collar.
"Get out of here!"
he yells. I take Ella's hand, and we run as fast as we can around the left side of the lake. Creighton begins firing, but it's not one gun that I hear, but two. And I can only hope it's Hector's finger pulling the second trigger. We race towards a cluster of trees sloping down from the mountainside, jutting out all the way to the water's bank. Our footsteps slap on the wet stones, and Ella's accelerated pace matches my own. Gunfire continues to rattle through the air, and just as it lets up, a loud animal roar booms over our head, causing me to stop short. I turn to look at the creature able to create such a paralyzing call, knowing it's not of this world. A long, muscular neck protrudes 10 or 15 stories out of the water, the flesh a gleaming gray. At the end of it, a giant lizard head separates its pebbled lips to show an enormous set of teeth.
"Olivia!"
Ella cheers. Olivia rears her head and lets loose another ear-splitting roar, and in the middle of it, a series of high-pitched yipping sounds roll down from the mountain. I look up and see a pack of small beasts descending towards the lake. I gasp.
"What are those?" I ask Ella.
"Crawls. Lots of them."
Olivia's neck is fully emerged and 30 stories high now, and as the rest of her body surfaces, her neck widens and her torso thickens. The Mogadorians immediately fire at her, and Olivia slams her head down on several at a time, creating large piles of ash. I can see the dark figures of Creighton and Hector, both with guns blazing. The Mogadorians fall back as 100 crawls enter the lake and swim towards Olivia. The creatures leap out of the water and attack. Many claw their way up Olivia's back and rip at the base of her neck. The lake water is soon streaked with blood.
"No!"
Ella screams. She tries running back, but I grab a hold of her arm. "We can't go back," I say.
"Olivia!"
"That's suicide, Ella. There's too many." Olivia roars in pain. She whips her head at her sides and back, trying to crush or bite the black crawls that have blanketed her. Creighton aims his gun at the beasts, but he lowers his weapon when he realizes he would most likely shoot Olivia in the process. He and Hector instead fire on the army of Mogadorians lining up and preparing for a new attack. Olivia wavers left and right, howls at the mountains, and backs herself up into the middle of the lake, and slowly sinks in a wave of red. The crawls detach and swim towards the Mogadorians.
"No!"
I hear Creighton yell above the chaos. I watch him try to enter the lake, but Hector pulls him back onto the shore.
"Duck!"
Ella screams, pulling me down by the arm. A whoosh of air passes over us. A giant black hoof smashes the ground next to me, and I look up to see a horned monster. Its head is as large as Hector's truck, and when the giant roars, my hair flaps in my face.
"Come on!"
I yell. We race towards the trees.
"Split up!"
Ella says. I nod and dart left, towards an ancient beech tree with gnarled limbs. I set the chest down and instinctively lift my hands and then pull them apart. To my surprise, the beech trunk opens, creating a hollow space that looks just big enough for two people and a chest to fit. I look over my shoulder to see the creature chasing Ella through a dense line of trees. I toss the chest in the open trunk, and with telekinesis, I pick up two trees and send them like missiles at the creature's back. They splinter against its dark skin with a loud crash, knocking it to its knees. I run and grab Ella's shaking hand, pulling her in the other direction. The beech tree, with my chest, comes into view.
"The tree, Ella! Get inside!"
I yell. She sits atop the chest and tries to make herself as compact as she can, shrinking down to a younger age.
"That's a pikin, Marina! Get in!"
she pleads. And before she can say another word, I close the trunk up around her, leaving just enough room so she can see.
"I'm sorry," I say through the small crevice, hoping the giant didn't see where I've stashed the chest and hidden my friend. I turn and run, trying to lead the pikin away, but it soon catches up and knocks me from behind. The force of the hit is shocking, and I fall down a steep slope until my arm finds a boulder to hook around. I look over my shoulder to see that I'm less than a meter from a rocky cliff. The pikin appears at the top of the slope. There, it shuffles sideways until it's positioned directly above me. It roars so loudly, my mind blanks. I hear Ella scream my name in the distance, but I can't breathe, let alone yell back. It marches down the slope. I raise one of my hands and uproot a small spindly tree near me and launch it at the giant's chest. It impales its chest, and it's enough for the pikin to lose its footing, and it falls sideways, shrieking and barreling right at me. I close my eyes and prepare for the impact, but instead of smashing me under its weight and knocking me over the cliff, its body hits the boulder I'm holding onto, and then bounces over me. I whip my head over my shoulder to see the pikin fall down the rocky cliff. I'm finally able to concentrate enough to float myself up the slope. I hurry back towards the beech tree, to Ella and my chest, and I hear the cannons blast a split second before I'm shot. The pain is double anything I've felt before, and all I can see is red and flashes of white. I roll around uncontrollably, writhing in agony,
Marina!
I hear Ella scream. I roll onto my back and stare at the sky. Blood drips out of my mouth and nose. I can taste it. I can smell it. A few birds circle overhead. As I wait to die, I watch as the sky is taken over by a colossal group of dark, heavy clouds. The clouds crash and roll on top of each other, pulsing as if they're breathing. I think I'm hallucinating, seeing visions before I die. When a massive drop of water hits me on the right cheek, I blink as another hits me above my eyes. And then a bolt of lightning splits the sky in two. A huge Mogadorian in gold and black armor stands over me, smiling. He presses a cannon against my temple and spits on the ground. But before he pulls the trigger, he looks up at the looming storm. I quickly place my hands on the gaping wound in my abdomen, feeling the icy familiarity surge under my skin. Then the oncoming rain washes over me as the clouds become a solid wall of darkness.
Chapter 31. By the look on Sam's face, I can tell he's just about lost all faith in getting out of here alive. My own shoulders sag as I stare into the massive white eyes of the beast that's rising to its feet in front of us. It takes its time, stretching its muscular neck, veins as thick as Roman columns protruding on both sides. The dark skin on its face is dry and cracked, like the stone jutting above its head. With its long arms, it has the look of an alien gorilla. By the time the giant has pushed itself into a full standing position, 50 feet tall, the handle of my dagger has melted itself around my right hand. "Flank it!" I yell. Sam runs left, and I dart right. Its first move is towards Sam, who immediately turns and runs along the circular edge of the moat. The beast lumbers after him, and that's when I sprint towards it and slide my dagger right and left, cutting small chunks from its calves. It rears its head and smashes its nose against the ceiling, and then swings a hand down at me, one of its fingers connecting with my back leg. I'm sent spinning into the wall, where I land on my left shoulder, dislocating it. "John!" Sam yells. The giant swings for me again, but I'm able to jump out of the path of its fist. The giant may be powerful, but it's slow. Still, the cave we're in is not large enough to run very far, so, slow or not, it still has the advantage. I don't see Sam anywhere as I stagger from boulder to boulder. The giant has a hard time following me, and once I figure I have enough time, I slowly raise my left arm above my head and rotate my hand so my palm is on the back of my head. The pain shoots from my neck to my heels, and before I give in to it, I keep reaching and feel my dislocated shoulder pop back into place. A sense of relief comes over me, but it's short-lived as I look up to see the giant's palm right above my head. I raise my dagger, and its blade punctures the beast's palm, but it's not enough to stop it from wrapping its fingers around me. It picks me up, and the strength of its squeeze causes the dagger to fall to the ground. I hear its diamond blade clang, and as I'm turned upside down, I search for it so I can use my telekinesis to retrieve it. "Sam, where are you?" I'm disoriented as the beast turns me right side up again, and it holds me a few feet above its nose. Then I see Sam emerge from a fissure in the wall. He runs and picks up my blade, and a second later, the giant squeals in shock and pain. It squeezes me hard, and I push back against its fingers as much as I can. As it stumbles backwards, I'm able to free my shoulders, arms, and hands. I turn on the lights of my palms and shine my lumen directly into its eyes. it's instantly blinded and backs into a wall. And that's when I'm able to pull the rest of my body free and jump. Sam tosses me my dagger, and I charge at the beast, plunging the blade into the skin between every toe. The giant howls. It bends over, and when it does, I shine my lumen again into its eyes. It loses its balance, and I make a boulder behind it dislodge and slam into its lower back. The beast pitches forward, its long arms straight out to break its fall. Its massive hands land in the moat of steaming green liquid, and the sound of its searing flesh comes a second later. I watch as the beast crashes into the base of the electrical force field and the thick stone pedestals holding the chests. The crash disrupts the force field and sends the pedestals flying across the room, breaking against the stone. The beast lies unmoving.
"Tell me you planned that,"
Sam says, following me towards the chests.
"I wish I could," I say.
I open my chest to find everything inside, including the coffee can of Henri's ashes and the volatile crystal that's wrapped in the towel.
"Looks good," I say.
Sam picks up the other chest.
"What happens when we go through that door?"
Sam says, nodding to the small wooden door we came in through. "We killed the beast, and we have the chests, but we can't turn ourselves invisible and just stroll by 100 Moogs. I open my chest and handle different crystals and objects. But again, I have no idea what most of them do, and the ones I do know how to use can't exactly get me through a mountain of aliens. Looking around the room, I'm losing hope. But it's after studying the giant's melting skin and disintegrating bones that I get an idea. With my dagger back in my jeans pocket, I slowly approach the moat of bubbling green liquid. I take a deep breath and carefully dip a finger in it. Just as I'd hoped. It's scalding hot, but merely tickles my skin like fire. It's like green lava.
"Sam?"
"Yeah?"
"When I say open the door, I want you to open it and get out of the way immediately."
"What are you going to do?"
he asks.
Visions of Henri running the Loric crystal over me as I lie on the coffee table, my hands in open flames, run through my mind, and I dunk my hand into the moat and pick up a dripping scoop of the green lava. I close my eyes and concentrate. And when I open them, the liquid is hovering over my hand in a perfect, flaming ball.
"This, I guess," I say.
"Wicked."
Sam runs over to the wooden door, and I nod to show him I'm ready. He rips the door open and dives to his right. A cluster of heavily armed Moogs are running our way, but when they catch sight of the fiery green ball coming their way, they try to turn around. As the ball is about to splash on the chest of the first Moog, I use my mind to spread it out like a fiery blanket. Several Moogs are hit, and after a moment of burning torture, they turn to ash. I wing ball after ball of green lava at more Moogs, knocking them down. Sam collects a pile of their guns, and once there's a lull in the advancement, I grab 2 more balls of green liquid and run out the door. Sam follows me with a long black gun under each arm. The number of Moogs running down the dark tunnel is staggering, and with the flashing lights and piercing sirens, it's a sensory overload. Sam pulls both triggers and mows down row after row of Moogs, but they keep coming. When he's out of bullets, Sam grabs 2 more guns.
"I could use some help here,"
Sam yells, mowing down another line of Moogs.
"I'm thinking, I'm thinking!"
The mucus-covered walls of the tunnel don't appear to lend themselves to spreading a decent fire, and I don't have enough of the green lava in my hands to do enough damage. To my left are the silver gas tanks and silos with their heavy pipes, spouts, and aluminum ducts. Next to the tallest of the silos, I eye the control panel, with electrical wires pouring out. I can hear the screams and roars of the beasts in the barred chambers farther down the hall, and wonder how hungry they are. I toss a flaming ball at the control panel, and it disintegrates in a storm of sparks. The bars of the chambers lining the walls begin to rise, and that's when I toss the other green ball at the base of the gas tanks and silos. I grab hold of Sam and sprint with him back into the giant's chamber. As the explosion erupts, I whip Sam against the stone section between the wooden door and the rising steel gate, and allow the advancing wave of flames to sweep over me. My ears are flooded with the crackle and hum of fire. Dozens of crawls burst from their open chamber and attack a series of unsuspecting Moogs from behind. Several Pykans stomp into the tunnel with roars and swinging arms. The reptilian mutant with horns charges towards the back of the tunnel, plowing over Moogs and crawls under the legs of the Pykans. The gargoyle-like winged creatures buzz at the ceiling, swooping down to take a bite out of anything they can. And the monster with transparent skin sinks its rows of teeth into the calf of a Pykan. That all happens in a matter of seconds. Then they're overtaken by a sea of fire. After a few minutes, once the fire escapes up the spiral cavern at the end of the tunnel to continue to wreak havoc throughout the mountain, the long corridor in front of me is littered with ash piles and black monster bones. I extinguish the fire surrounding me and brush my hands off onto my thighs. Sam is singed, but otherwise, okay. "Brilliant, dude," he says. "Let's just try to get the hell out of here, and then we can celebrate." I stick my chest under my arm, and Sam picks up the other. We race through the fire's destruction. The stench of death is choking. The charred ladder at the end of the tunnel appears stable, and with only one free hand apiece, we climb with difficulty. Our feet hit the burned and blackened spiral ledge, and we sprint around and around until we reach the cave center. The inferno I unleashed did much more damage than I thought it would, and we see piles upon piles of ash. But we also see hundreds of Moogs crawling out of different corridors and tunnels on their hands and knees, burned or still on fire, barking in pain, unable to pick up their guns, unable to do anything as we jump over them. There are other soldiers racing above us on ledges, some with weapons in their arms, others with the wounded. I'm confused which way the exit is, and as I lead us through a series of tunnels with my pendant swinging around my neck, Sam and I each pick up a discarded gun. We run with them chest high, firing at anything that gets in our way. Even though we don't know where we're going, we don't stop moving until we come to the cells with human prisoners. That's when I know for certain we've gone the wrong way. I pull Sam in the other direction, but he plants his feet and stops me. I can see the concern and hope on his face. The cells have their steel doors stuck a foot above the floor, and the bubbling blue force fields have disappeared.
"They're open, John,"
he yells, tossing his chest at my feet. I drop my gun and pick up the other chest, and Sam finally says what I knew he was thinking.
"What if my dad's here?"
I look into Sam's eyes, and I know we have to check. He runs along the left side of the corridor, yelling into each cell for his dad. I'm investigating the cells on the right when a boy my age with long black hair sticks his head under a door. When he sees me, he puts a hand cautiously into the corridor.
"The force field is really gone?"
he shouts.
"I think so," I yell.
Sam hoists his gun over his shoulder and ducks his head under the boy's cell door.
"Do you know a man named Malcolm Good? 40 years old, brown hair? Is he here? Have you seen him?"
"Shut up and stand back, kid,"
I hear the boy say. There's a grittiness to his voice, something that makes me uneasy, and I immediately pull Sam to the side. The boy grips the bottom of the door and rips it from the wall.